Who really runs America? Most of us would say the people, pointing to elections, town halls, and our cherished system of checks and balances. But what if the reality is far more concentrated and far more troubling? In 1956, sociologist C. Wright Mills published a book that shattered comfortable assumptions about American democracy. He revealed that beneath the surface of democratic ritual, a small, interconnected circle of military generals, corporate executives, and political insiders were making the decisions that shaped American life. The rest of us? We were spectators in our own democracy. This wasn't conspiracy theory. It was institutional analysis, and it struck a nerve that still reverberates today. As wealth inequality reaches historic levels and corporate influence permeates every corner of political life, Mills' insights feel less like history and more like prophecy. Understanding the power elite isn't about cynicism. It's about seeing clearly how power actually operates in modern America. Power in America concentrates in those commanding major institutions, corporations, the military, and the state. These are the power elite, and their influence stems from their positions, not personal genius. Strip a CEO of their title, and they become ordinary. What matters is organizational control. The CEO through capital, the general through military resources, the cabinet secretary through bureaucratic authority. These three domains have become increasingly intertwined. The same people rotate between them. Executives become defense secretaries, generals join corporate boards, politicians transition to lobbying firms. Success in one sphere opens doors to others, creating an elite that is both exclusive and self-perpetuating. This is America's invisible government, not a conspiracy, but a convergence of institutional power operating largely beyond public scrutiny or democratic accountability. American wealth has transformed dramatically. Before the Civil War, George Washington's $530,000 estate represented extraordinary wealth. The war's economic upheaval and corporate-friendly legal frameworks unleashed unprecedented accumulation, creating industrial titans with unimaginable fortunes by 1900. The numbers reveal the closing of opportunity. In 1900, 39% of the very rich came from lower-class origins. By 1950, this plummeted to 9%, while 68% came from upper-class backgrounds. The American dream persists, but upward mobility has narrowed. Real fortunes now come from strategic positions, providing access to capital, insider information, and financial speculation, not salary alone. Celebrity culture provides a glittering distraction. Cafe society, where institutional elites mingle with entertainers under publicity spotlight, emerged in the 1920s and has intensified since. This world offers a prestige system for the power elite while diverting public attention from actual power centers. We know more about celebrity divorces than corporate mergers reshaping our economy. The spectacle of celebrity has become democracy's opiate, keeping us entertained while the serious business of power unfolds elsewhere. Walk into any major American corporation, and you'll find white, Protestant, urban-born, Ivy League-educated men from business families running things. This isn't coincidence. It's selection. Today's chief executives aren't self-made entrepreneurs. Only 6% built companies from nothing, down from 36% two generations ago. Instead, 68% have risen through corporate hierarchies, where advancement depends less on merit than on fitting in. The modern executive differs fundamentally from industrial titans of the past. Those earlier figures were crude, creative, and ruthless. They built industries through force of personality. Today's corporate leader is a professional coordinator who approves decisions flowing upward. Success requires mastering corporate politics, forming alliances, avoiding controversy, embodying the values of those above you. Executives speak of luck determining their careers, but this really means being chosen by superiors, being recognized as sound. This creates a self-perpetuating system. Hierarchies select for conformity and political skill rather than innovation. Corporations cultivate tomorrow's leaders through recruitment programs and psychological assessments, reproducing a particular type of person. The result is an executive class that thinks alike, socializes together, and shares a worldview shaped by corporate interests, a worldview they carry into government positions and military advisory roles. For most of American history, geographic isolation kept the military marginal. The Constitution deliberately subordinated generals to civilian authority. But the 20th century shattered this. War preparedness became the normal condition, an emergency without foreseeable end. The Pentagon symbolizes this transformation, the world's largest office building, housing over 31,000 people connected by 17 miles of corridors. Today's generals are professionalized executives managing vast bureaucracies, obsessed with rank, where status determines everything from housing to social functions. Military training creates commanders who succeed in closed hierarchies where debate isn't valued. Since Pearl Harbor, military leaders have gained unprecedented influence over economic planning, foreign policy, and scientific research. Military spending consistently exceeds 30% of the federal budget. By 1954, 85% of federal research funding served national security projects. Civilian diplomacy has atrophied, dismissed as appeasement. These men with limited imagination occupied positions of great decision, not because they sought power, but through the default of civilian political leadership. The power elite isn't a conspiracy. It's a natural convergence of institutional leaders sharing backgrounds, schools, and clubs. A corporate executive believes what benefits his company serves America because corporate life shaped his worldview. A general sees foreign policy through military strategy. A politician courting donors equates business interests with public good. This creates interchangeable leadership. Executives become cabinet members. Generals join corporate boards. Politicians become lobbyists. Each rotation strengthens connections, unifying perspectives at the top. The system's insidiousness lies in its unaccountability. In mass society, where participation is symbolic, the power elite operate through organizations appearing democratic while concentrating decisions upward. Legislative gridlock prevents oversight. Political connections fill key positions. Official secrecy shields major decisions from debate. The result? Democracy in form, oligarchy in function, popular sovereignty's appearance masking concentrated power's reality. The power elite didn't seize control through violence. They filled the vacuum created by declining democratic participation. Perhaps most troubling isn't that a power elite exists, but that it operates without moral authority or genuine accountability. Mills called this the higher immorality, not individual corruption, but systemic institutional immorality normalized across business, warfare, and politics. Traditional values have become hollow rituals, leaving people morally adrift and politically indifferent. Washington officials maintain political habits without believing in founding principles. The corporate rich exercise power without moral legitimacy, masking their interests behind empty slogans. Success now emphasizes effective personality over character, reducing personal relations to public relations. The typical elite member values weight and judgment over intellectual depth, creating leaders who lack knowledge to comprehend the systems they control. Unlike historical figures like Washington or Jefferson, who possessed genuine learning and moral authority, today's leaders are mere politicians with carefully manufactured images. Professional celebrities and mid-level politicians dominate through organized irresponsibility, a system where no one is accountable because power is so diffused and hidden. The power elite presents itself as meritocratic, but merit now means conformity to institutional demands. They claim to serve the public while primarily benefiting themselves, speaking of democracy while operating through bureaucratic hierarchies citizens cannot access. Mills wrote in 1956, but he was describing dynamics that have only intensified. The question isn't whether a power elite exists. The evidence is overwhelming. The question is whether we'll continue accepting the comfortable fiction of broadly distributed power or demand genuine democratic accountability.